Welcome once again as MIT Professor Paul Samuelson discusses the current economic scene. This series is produced by Instructional Dynamics Incorporated. Professor Samuelson, now that the recession is apparently behind us, what are your thoughts on the longer-term prospects for economic growth worldwide in this century?
It's true that the recession of 1974-1975 does look to be behind us in the sense that we hit bottom in May, but the rest of the world still has to look forward to the end of its recession. Still, let's take the dangerous road and try for the occasion to be a futurologist. I've been asked by a Brazilian publication to speculate on what will happen to the world economy for the rest of this century. So here goes. If we read the writings of the famous Club of Rome studies, those on limits of growth by Professor Meadows and World Dynamics by Professor Forrester, many of them written right here at MIT, we must regard growth as very soon to be a thing of the past. Natural resources are finite, and hence, according to the new computer version of the old Malthusian theory, continued population growth must spell out a decline in the standard of living, to say nothing of producing an overcrowded and polluted environment. Yet, in the year 2000, when economic historians come to look back on the last quarter of the 20th century, I rather doubt that they will find the facts in close agreement with the explicit and implicit predictions and policy recommendations of the new Malthusians. To be sure, the natural rate of population growth will be falling almost everywhere in the world. Still, world population will then be billions higher than in 1975, and for the most part, material living standards can be expected, I think, to continue their long historical climb. So let me review the evidence on which I base these predictions. That way, any reader can then form his own opinion and modify my guesses as he thinks best. What are present global trends? So far in the 1970s, total world GNP, expressed in real terms after appropriate adjustments are made for price inflation, seems to have been growing at an average annual rate of perhaps 5%. In 1973, when the advanced countries were going into a growth recession, world GNP, and that's the last year for which we have complete figures yet, seemed to grow at more than 6%. It was a year of good crops. With world population growing in the 1970s at about 2% per year, this means that real per capita income in the 1970s has been averaging out a growth rate of about 3% per year on the average. This is in contrast to what was happening in the decades around 1900, when I suppose it might be said that capitalism was at its peak, because it's been estimated that in those years, total world GNP grew only about 2 or 3% per year, with per capita incomes, therefore, scarcely rising at all on the average as population then soared. Within this global pattern, of course, we discern special regional trends. We discern the decline of the position of the leader, that is the United States. The United States, with only about 6% of world population, now enjoys a bit more than 25% of world GNP. However, at the end of World War II, my guess is that the U.S. share was almost a half of world GNP. In the 1950s, our share sank to below 40%. In the 1960s, to below 30%. Now it's about 26%. If the world develops as it ought to, by the end of the century, the U.S. share should be below 20%, but not, I hasten to add, below 6% or down to 6%. As an American patriot and as a citizen of the world, I rejoice in this salutary trend. The rest of the world's gain is not our loss. Now that a typical Swiss and Swede have almost as high real incomes as my American neighbors, we in America still get every bit as much pleasure as we ever did from our increasingly comfortable standard of life. What I do regret is the inequality of development, that the prizes in the growth sweepstakes have been going not to the underdeveloped world with its historical poverty, but rather primarily to the less than most affluent economies of Western Europe, Australasia, and Japan. These countries deserve their new sprint towards prosperity, but I wish that some of that same good luck could rub off and happen to India and Bangladesh, to Egypt, Haiti, El Salvador, Ghana, and Argentina. It's not true that the less developed countries fail these days to make progress. What would have been miracles of growth in the old days of undiluted capitalism have been occurring regularly over recent decades in Taiwan, Thailand, Mexico, Singapore, Puerto Rico, Spain, and some Eastern European socialist economies like Bulgaria. This is without regard to what the accidental discovery of rich oil deposits can do for a Venezuela, a Nigeria, or your random run-of-the-mill Persian Gulf sheikdom. But alas, the picture is spotty. A Brazil may flourish where a Chile will stagnate. Many Asian and African countries, freed at long last from the fetters of colonialism, have introduced elaborate plans for socialism, five-year plans, 10-year plans, plans that do not seem to be worth the paper they're written on. Well, so far I've been speaking of the present and the past. What about the future? Will new rules apply to it? Is the fourfold increase in oil price engineered by the OPEC cartel merely one sign that the day of judgment is fast approaching, when scarce natural resources will have been exhausted? Are repeated Russian grain purchases an omen that the number of hungry stomachs is finally outstripping the amount of food that men's arms can wrest from the soil? No scholar has the right to be dogmatic about the future. But let it be noted that the quantum jump in oil prices is much more a reflection of a newly formed and newly firmed monopoly than of actual depletion of known geologic reserves. If Saudi Arabia and Kuwait threw upon the world all of the oil they were capable of producing in the same fashions that such countries used to do, we would, I am sure, many times in the next 10 years witness sharp drops in world energy prices. I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not one of those economists who are constantly predicting with great confidence that the OPEC monopoly will break down or will break down soon. But I am an economist who believes that you should call a spade and a monopoly a monopoly. Well, similarly, let's consider the prospects for food production. It is not the case that agriculture experiences less technological advance than industry. Historical statistics show otherwise. Now, it may be the case that world climate is now going through a new cycle. Perhaps in two centuries we shall be in a new ice age. Perhaps the Sahara and the Indian Peninsula are in for an extraordinary frequency of droughts and disappointing monsoons and disappointing harvests. But knowing the difficulties of identifying genuine rather than spurious statistical cycles, I should not like to bet that scientists' discovery of new hybrid grains, pesticides, fertilizers, and improved farming methods will fall behind the indicated rise in world population in the years ahead. What I think one can legitimately fear is that certain regions will, on numerous occasions in the next quarter century, experience disastrous crop failures and mass starvation. Hundreds of millions of people will at those times have to throw themselves on the mercy of the luckier world powers. I don't think one has to be a pessimist or a cynic to have doubts that the philanthropic response will at such times be fully adequate to alleviate the human distress and suffering. One doubts the adequacy of the response. And I don't think that this rather gloomy foreboding of mine will be materially exercised by any of the various international stockpiling schemes that I believe possess any realistic feasibility. Well, what will be the economic pecking order in the year 2000? A couple of decades from now, an observer of the world from outer space will, I suspect, at first glance, think that matters have not changed much. The highest standards of living will still be in the temperate zones, in Europe, North America, and regions below the Tropic of Capricorn, Australia, New Zealand, perhaps Chile, Argentina, Brazil. The tropics and the polar regions will still offer the greatest challenge to longevity and a comfortable life. But at a second glance, I think that observer will see some notable changes. Although Japan's miraculous growth spurt of the 1950s and 1960s must in all likelihood abate somewhat, still, I suspect she should be able to maintain a positive growth differential over the other advanced nations of at least a couple of percent per annum. Small differences like this accumulated compound interest, and they should serve to bring the Japanese standard of life to the top of the pack by the end of the century. Can one extrapolate for a country like, say, Brazil, a continuation of her recent spectacular progress? In terms of size, resources, and cultural mix of her population, Brazil could be on the brink of a long-term takeoff. Temporarily, by virtue of her strong governmental structure, Brazil has avoided some of the turmoil and disorganization that results in modern democracies as the electorates are subject to a wave of so-called rising expectations and rising insistence on entitlements. However, the history in many countries of strong governments whose early economic successes do not last makes it hazardous for the social profit to extrapolate over the long run real growth rates in the neighborhood of 10% per annum, such as Brazil has in many recent years been experiencing. Still, if even 6% real growth could be achieved over the long pull, that would bring Brazil to preeminent economic position in Latin America and into the general range of affluence of Great Britain. For a semi-tropical country with a diverse ethnic background, this would indeed be a notable achievement for Brazil. Still more dangerous it is to guess on the future of mainland China. Its stability and the degree of equality in which it shares what we must remember is still a very low standard of living. These are impressive. But one has to remember how promising looked the future of Soviet growth in the early 1930s, and how many have been the vicissitudes in the years since then. Beyond guessing that China will do better than India in the rest of this century, one must reserve judgment. It's interesting to speculate on what is going to happen to those Persian Gulf countries born with the equivalent of a golden spoon in their mouth namely with rich oil resources. These certainly provide the wherewithal that could make for a rapid increase in the general standard of life. At first, it will be rational for these countries to use much of the surplus funds which they earn because of the new higher price of oil on foreign investment, letting the money grow at a compound rate of return. Not all of the funds, of course, can prudently be invested in this direction. Much should be invested in domestic development at home. But there is a limit to the absorption capacity that those countries, in the present state of their sophistication, can, in the short run, invest at home. Increasingly, if the initial developmental programs at home turn out to be successful, the foreign kitty built up by investment abroad should be drawn down on to turn the desert sands into industrial gold. However, one does not find in history very many cases where, let us say, impoverished peasants, hillbillies, have had lightning strike in the form of lottery winnings or oil strikes and gold strikes in which those peoples have moved rapidly ahead into the ranks of the affluent. The Navajo Indians may well have benefited from domestic oil lease lands in the United States, but we do not consider the average Navajo today as free of oil, having a sustaining income base equivalent to that of the average Episcopalian or average Presbyterian, just to mention two of the more affluent sects of churches upon which statistics have been collected. The Shah of Iran may be correct that his country will, by the next decade, be moving to the standard of life of a typical Western European country, Belgium, Holland, Ireland, the UK. But knowing how low is the base from which they start, and knowing how vulnerable to error and corruption and to political turnover are the planning agencies of countries at that stage of development, I would not like to make book at long odds that history will record that the Shah of Iran is correct in his prediction. And the same can be said for Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Libya, even though, as we now look at real incomes, dividing the total of the annual increment to wealth in those countries by the total of the population, we find that they no longer belong among the underdeveloped countries, but had to be moved in with the United States. Whether when the oil gives out in Kuwait and in Iraq and Libya, it'll be a longer time before that event happens in Saudi Arabia. But when that event happens, will the oil that has come out of the ground have been transmuted by the alchemy of prudent investment into industrial plant and equipment which can maintain those high standards of living and a trend parallel with that of the development of the most advanced countries. It is a possibility, but I think that I would still say that the issue is moot. Let me think aloud and say a few words about the relative prospects of the totalitarian planned socialist communist countries in comparison with the rest of the mixed economies. At first blush, one might think that a controlled economy dedicated to the eradication of poverty and to growth could outperform a market economy which depends upon the day-to-day saving decisions of individuals, individuals who are being bombarded by television performances which dangle before them attractive ways of spending on current consumption. So that even if you live in a poor state of the Union, like Mississippi, you hanker after the same sleek automobiles and the same luxuries of food as the more affluent people from California and from the northern industrial states. Well, the same thing happens on a international scale. The more austere controlled economies can, you would think, presumably, by fiat, hold down the level of current consumption. This is straight capitalistic reasoning that I'm giving as applied to real capital, but not to privately owned capital. They convert current consumption into new capital formation in a larger percentage than do the market economies, and so they can be expected to grow more. So might run the argument. I have even heard it said, it's now perhaps two decades ago, by Professor Peter Wiles of the London School of Economics, an expert on the Soviet Union, an Oxford-trained economist, trained around World War II, that the socialist communist societies are less efficient at any stage of the game than the market economies. So they do not arrange the elements of the vector of what can be produced in an efficient way, as efficiently as the market economies. But since they grow at a more rapid percentage rate than the market economies, even an inefficiently arranged vector of elements, which continually grows at 8%, will ultimately, in every element of the vector, outstrip the efficient market economy, which grows at only 5 or 6%. If you had acted upon the Wiles prediction these last 20 years, you would have been in for a surprise, because it turns out that those controlled economies do not grow in all the elements of the vector at 8%. On the contrary, Professor Bergson, who was our foremost American authority on the Soviet system, in many recent publications, most notably in the Vixell lectures he gave this summer, in Stockholm, has shown that it's extremely unlikely that the Soviet economy will in the 1970s and 1980s be able to maintain the growth rate of the 1950s. That growth rate was premised upon both a recovery from wartime devastation — we always know that such growth can be rapid — but also it was very heavily capital using. And it will be very hard to maintain the same incremental deepening of capital in the years ahead for purely arithmetical reasons. It looks as if the Chinese system has done better in meeting the problem of agricultural advance and agricultural reform. China, in a good year now, is, the experts tell us, almost self-sufficient in grains. She is using good hybrid seed, some of it developed by the Rockefeller Foundation in Mexico, but some of it developed in China itself. She is spreading the knowledge of this technology. She doesn't have as much inorganic fertilizer. There is apparent unity, you might call it docility, if you like, of the Chinese people, which perhaps augurs well for their kind of controlled system. But we have to remember that they do start from a very, very low base. I might mention a very interesting comparison that I've seen out of Ann Arbor, the group survey center there, done by an emeritus professor from the University of Bridgeport, which compares Bulgaria and Greece. And on another occasion, I'll go into the details of that comparison. Well, my time is almost up. One cannot conclude a discussion of long-range forecasting without emphasizing that precision in long-run forecasting is a myth. Surprise should never surprise the futurologist. Karl Marx, Oswald Spengler, Thorstein Veblen, Arnold Toynbee, Joseph Schumpeter, they are like poets, not like scientists. They aren't even like historians. The world as it is today was predicted by nobody, not by Marx or Engels or Lenin, not by Vilfredo Pareto or Friedrich von Hayek, not by Henry Adams or de Tocqueville, not by John Maynard Keynes, although he did come remarkably close in his 1930 article on economics for our grandchildren. But then even a random archer must, by chance alone, sometime come close. Nevertheless, the future is not a matter of sheer chance. It grows organically out of the present and the past. The analyst must peer into a glass darkly as best he can to appraise the likelihoods. And finally, if he is honest, he must warn against the imprecision of even his best guesses or visions.
If you have any comments or questions for Professor Samuelson, address them to Instructional Dynamics Incorporated, 450 East Ohio Street, Chicago, Illinois, 60611.